It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we talk to a UW-Madison grad who found a new life and a way to tell our life stories through map making. First, the election of Democrat Patty Shockner to Wisconsin's 10th Senate District seat has grabbed the attention of politics watchers around the state and nationwide. The district easily went to Donald Trump in the 2016 general election, and the seat has been held by a Republican since 2001. The win is the latest in a series of victories for Democrats in areas that have been largely seen as GOP strongholds, and Shockner's win was called a, quote, wake-up call for Republicans by Governor Scott Walker. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you live in that district, what did you think of that outcome? Or wherever you are in the state, what do you think it means for November's elections? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Paul Nolette joins us now. He's an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Hi, great to talk with you.
Well, what were your thoughts on the 10th Senate special election? Does this mean something?
Well, I think it does. I mean, it was certainly an upset win in a Republican-leaning district by Shockner. But I think it also ties into the success that Democrats have had in other state legislative races all the way through 2017 and then now at the start of 2018, where Democrats have actually had success building upon their percentages, even in Republican districts like this district.
This is one Senate seat, one state Senate seat. Usually this kind of election gets overshadowed by other stuff going on, like this year, the race for governor, U.S. Senate, you name it. Are we grasping at tea leaves here a little bit?
I don't think so. I mean, because if you put it in the broader context of these other races, both on the federal level and the state level, various special elections, of which there have been several dozen when you combine federal and state over the past year, Democrats on average have gained about 10 points above what typically Democrats get in the districts that they're running in. And so I think it's this one Senate seat itself. Well, I think you want to be careful not to take too much out of it and try to say, well, this guarantees that the Republicans are going to lose, you know, the U.S. House or something. But I do think it's an indication that Democratic enthusiasm amongst their voters is pretty high.
People have pointed towards some themes in places like Virginia and this district, which has a mix of different demographics, but it includes some suburban areas from across the Minnesota border, basically some college areas. Republicans worried that they're losing voters in those kind of regions. Is that something you're seeing?
Yeah, and I think the Virginia elections that you mentioned earlier this past November were really emblematic of that shift in the suburbs. And I think to some degree, this district may help show that as well. But I think one other thing that this particular race indicates is, I mean, this was a district that Barack Obama, in his reelection race, had lost this district by, I believe, 6 points. But Trump won it by 17 points. So it actually swung heavily towards Trump not all that long ago, in November of 2016, but already it shifted pretty dramatically in the other direction.
As we mentioned, Governor Walker called this election a wake-up call. Paul Ryan said it's time for Republicans to pay attention here. And there's been a flurry of activity. Governor Walker said, hey, we need to tell our good news story here. Low unemployment in Wisconsin, economy doing pretty good. Foxconn on the way. Are those the kind of messages you expect to hear from Republicans as we head toward November?
I certainly think it makes a lot of sense to push those messages. I think the concern amongst Republicans is that this Democratic success in, you know, building upon their past percentages in numerous districts across the country is happening despite the fact that the national economy is actually doing quite well. And, you know, there's been some economic successes here in Wisconsin as well, when you mentioned Foxconn, for instance. But nevertheless, Democrats are still building upon their success. So I think the concern amongst Republicans is, yes, we need to get those messages out, but are they really going to work in the end?
Talking to Paul Nolet, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University, looking at this week's special Senate election in Wisconsin, getting a lot of attention, a big swing there from Republican to Democrat. Is it a sign for the future? Patty Shockner was asked about whether or not she saw her election there as a sign of things to come. Here's part of what she said.
I don't know. I don't know what the big picture is. All I know is I'm a mom, a wife, and a grandma. And, you know, mom, wife, grandmas, dads, grandpas, all we want is the best for our kids and our community and our grandkids, and that's what I want.
It reminds me, Paul, a little bit of some of the things we heard from Doug Jones, the successful Alabama Democrat who won a Senate election there, in some ways not nationalizing the race, not partisanizing the race, trying to come across as a qualified, concerned, old-fashioned candidate. Do you see that as a trend for Democrats?
Well, I think in certain districts like this one that are either heavily Republican or Republican-leaning, it makes a lot of sense for Democrats to say, look, I'm not going to be talking about Donald Trump all the time. What I want to be talking about is things like addressing the opioid crisis and issues that are impacting the local community. And I think Patty Shockner did that successfully, and I think it can be a go-to strategy for Democrats in these sorts of districts across the country.
Is there a tendency for, after a party has control of a state government for a while, for there to be eventually a swing, regardless of the conditions on the ground? We saw between, 2008 and just 2010, actually, a big swing here from Democrat to Republican. Is it likely that at some point that's just going to swing back?
A lot of times that's what's happened, particularly in the last couple decades of American politics, both on the federal level and on the state level. You've had this back and forth of party control as voters are disappointed by those elected in the previous elections, and they go in a different direction. And I think to some degree that's what's happening here in Wisconsin, although really what's dragging Republicans down in all these special elections, including this one, is actually the national environment. So it's sort of ironic because, I mean, this is one state Senate seat in Wisconsin, and Patty Shockner didn't nationalize the race, but nevertheless, the context is that Democratic voters are really fired up. They want to get some wins wherever they are, and Patty Shockner was able to take advantage of that, even though she didn't explicitly nationalize the race.
Let's talk about some of the basics, like candidate recruitment. Is this an environment where Democrats are going to have an easier time, even than they would have had 2-4 years ago, bringing candidates into races, maybe Republicans having a harder time?
Yes, and that's politicians are going to, or those who are planning on running or thinking about running, are certainly cognizant of the political environment. Is this going to be a good Republican year? Is this going to be a good Democratic year, or what? And if you look across the country, including here in Wisconsin, at how many Democrats are running for offices, both federal offices and state offices, it's really astounding. You see that here in the Wisconsin governor's race on the Democratic side with a very large field already. And you see this across the country, even in state legislative races, where Democrats are lining up to run, whereas Republicans are getting increasingly nervous about the prospects in 2018.
I want to ask you, Paul, to predict the outcome, but what are you going to be watching for between now and Election Day, November?
A couple things in particular. One is Donald Trump's approval rating and whether that stays where it is right now, which is really quite low for a president in this stage of his presidency. So number one, looking at that, because even in state races, even in state assembly or state Senate races, that's going to have an impact. And then the other thing is the economy as well. If the economy stays the way it is now, going pretty strong, then at least that gives something of a floor potentially for Republicans. But if, let's say that the United States and including Wisconsin goes into a recession, well then things could go from bad to worse for Republicans. So both the economy and Trump's approval rating are two key things to look at.
Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
That's Paul Nolet, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. He joined us to talk about the surprise outcome of the special election in Wisconsin's 10th State Senate District and what it could mean for both parties going forward. Right now, a new startup project out of UW-Madison's Discovery to Product program uses maps as storytelling devices to retrace our steps and find out how we became who we are today. Dean Olson is a UW-Madison grad and the founder of a program called Life Mapping. Twists and turns in his own life took him from Madison to New York and back, where he had to rebuild his life from the ground up. Dean, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, the story of life mapping is also the story of your life in a way.
Yeah.
Talk about where you were. Things went pretty wrong for you.
Oh, things went real wrong. I was an executive in the advertising world in New York, in London, and the family disease of alcoholism found me. Mm-hmm. And probably easier to find me in the advertising field too, because there's a lot of use there. And so what I found was I was just sinking and sinking. I'd been fired from quite a few jobs. And I was living in New York on the Upper East Side, about half a block from the Museum of Art there. Very nice part of town. Mm-hmm. But I was a falling down, literal drunk.
And you ended up, your family helped you get into some rehab.
Mm-hmm.
The condition was you had to not stay in New York, not go home to Chicago. You ended up coming to Wisconsin,
right.
Back to Wisconsin.
Right. I got the bachelor's from here and in geography, and I still had some friends here, and they had set things up and they said, you know, why don't you come back here, which sounds strange, to come back here to actually sober up. Mm-hmm. But I did.
And let's get into, you were a geography major, mm-hmm. and maps ended up being a big part of your story. Talk about, you were working with a man who had Alzheimer's disease,
yep.
And that's where the maps entered the picture.
That's true. After I cleaned myself up, about the only places that would hire me were these care facilities. And so I began working with a physician, and when I showed him a map of the Georgetown area, he said, oh, I know this. And he began sharing stories that he probably hadn't thought of in years.
The map triggered these stories.
Yes. And it was really cool, because it was hard for him to remember where he even was, but he could remember all about the dorm in which he lived.
So that set you to thinking. So talk mm-hmm. about the path from there to this idea of a structured system to mm-hmm. use maps to help us tell our stories.
Well, I needed to find a new profession. And so I was here in town, and there was a GIS certificate program which I applied for and was accepted into, and I began to see that I could actually make an interactive map that could help folks retell their stories place by place.
And GIS, that's a geographic information system. So mm-hmm. using maps to tell stories.
Right.
Basically,
right. Yeah. And so I found out that the concept was well within the realm of the possible.
So how did you start to try to put that into practice?
Well, the folks in the Department of Geography here were really, really helpful. And they provided me with the expertise, the skills, and the emotional support for me to start over.
We're talking to Dean Olson. He's a UW-Madison grad who came back here. He's working on a program called Life Mapping, using maps to help us visualize the stories of our lives. Now, this is still in the works, but Dean, paint us a picture of what this would actually look like. If I sat down and tried life mapping, what would I do? What would I get out of it?
Okay, well, today is the first day that we are live.
Oh, you are? Okay.
Yes, yes. And folks should go to the website at lifemapping.co. I'm sure folks can tell I have a little stutter.
Sure.
And that's cool. And then at first, this is a website where you go and map your actual path through life.
Mm-hmm.
And we start off where you were born, and then we include in all your homes and where you went to school and where you worked. And then we begin to ask you questions about where was your first kiss, where and when had you first thought that there might be a God. And these can be quite intimate, or they can be, please explain the trip to school. But on a more fundamental level here, life mapping is about stories and about the importance of stories. We have much, much peer-reviewed research that says stories and story sharing makes for stronger families, more resilient children, elders who are less depressed and spend less time in the hospital. It's just really all a positive thing.
And when I've done this and I've created my life map with the stories attached to it, I could do it just for me,
yep.
Or I could, mm-hmm. if I choose, selectively share it with others, right?
Yes. Yes. And the sharing is actually pretty exciting because, you know, I think it's a good thing for us to know ourselves, but I think it's really fundamental for us to share our stories of strength, our stories of overcoming obstacles with the people who are close to us, so they know that they have someone to turn to when things maybe aren't so hot for them.
And what has this meant, bringing it back to your story, what has this meant for you as you mapped your own life but also figured out a way to share this concept with others?
Well, it has provided me with a focus in life. It has provided me with a reason to stay sober. It has provided me with a goal which I think is spiritual. I think that this sharing of stories and hearing other folks' stories saved my life, and it made me see that I could be the hero of my own life. I want to share that with folks around my age so they can recall the events of their life and see that, you know, I have been the hero of my own life, and I should share that with my family, especially the younger members.
I'll say I love this idea as a kind of a map nerd myself, but also I've been going through old pictures and a lot of stuff lately,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and we have so much data about our lives in a way, like with the mm-hmm. pictures, with what we've done, where we've lived, and it's hard to make sense of it all. This is a way to give it something to hang all that data from.
Right, right. This would work especially well with a photo collection. But what it can do is it can turn the facts you have into stories, and folks respond to stories. They don't really respond to the facts nearly as much.
So this is live today. Have you guinea pigged this with some other people?
We have, but it's still kind of rough.
Uh-huh.
But I think folks will find that it works pretty well. You know, it might look not quite what I'd hope for, but we're going to be putting in a lot of tweaks.
This is a beta sort
yes,
of right now.
Yes, this is a beta.
But even with the rough draft versions, I can imagine people really getting hooked on this. What's been the response when you've done this with people?
The people have said, we love this. This is so cool. And you know, it's made me so happy that this really seems to hit a chord with folks, especially folks around my age, 50 plus.
But you do the map. It's all your past, but I assume there's still room to add.
Yes.
Because you're not done.
Yes, right. You are not actually dead yet. So we encourage you to plow forward here. You know, it's sort of like a Facebook, but for the important stories, for the important people.
And going through and doing this in the past, I imagine it might help you or others chart a course for the future.
Oh, yeah, sure. Sure. I mean, at the very least, it provides me with the courage to know I have overcome some really hard stuff, and I'm a lot stronger than I sometimes think I am, and I want everyone to have that same experience.
Dean, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Dean Olson. He's the founder of Life Mapping, a new startup out of UW-Madison's Discovery to Product program. It uses maps as a way to help us tell our life stories. Search for Life Mapping, lifemapping.com.
Lifemapping.co, not com.
Lifemapping.co, and you can check it out. They're looking for people to try out the beta version. Being a parent with disabilities can come with many obstacles, and our next guest says those obstacles include unfair treatment by the legal system and child welfare services. Parents with disabilities are brought into the court system by child protective agencies more frequently compared to non-disabled parents. Once in the court system, their parental rights are more likely to be terminated. Our guest says this is often because of discrimination rather than concern for the child's well-being. Robin Powell is an attorney and writer who focuses on disability law and policy. She's also a research associate at the National Center for Parents with Disabilities. Robin, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you shared in a recent piece, Robin, stories of a couple of families who faced what you say is unfair treatment by Child Protective Services and other agencies. Can you share a story or two with us?
Sure. So a recent case involved two parents in Oregon who have two children, and both of their children were removed shortly after the birth because the parents both have intellectual disabilities, so lower IQs. And the parents have been fighting for 4 years now to retain custody of their children. And just last month, they were granted custody after a very long court battle for one of their children. However, they're still going to court for the custody of the other child.
And you write that they had a long list of hoops they had to jump through in that effort.
Yeah, so they were told they would need to take a number of parenting classes and trainings and so forth, and they did every single class and every single training. And after every course they completed successfully, they were told, now you need to do another one and another one. And, you know, I spoke with the mother, and she spoke about how she just felt like she was held to such a higher standard than any other parent, and she was successful in all of these courses she was taking.
And talk about that higher standard more generally. You write that a parent with disabilities maybe gets a closer eye, a closer watch from, say, a child services agency.
Yeah, so parents with disabilities are really held to this higher standard. They're supposed to be these super parents, and if a parent with a disability needs any sort of help or is assumed to need any sort of help, that just inherently means that they're incapable of raising their children. And the fact is that every parent, whether they have a disability or not, needs some sort of help. You know, it really does take a village to raise a child. And unfortunately, if a parent has a disability, they're just assumed to not be able to raise that child.
Can you talk about the scope of this? How many parents are out there with disabilities raising children, and what kind of disabilities are we talking about?
Sure. So, honestly, the estimates range right now. So there's an anywhere from 4.1 million to 10 million parents in the United States who have a disability, depending on how you define disability. But very generally, I mean all disabilities, so I'm talking about parents who may have intellectual disabilities, as well as parents who may have psychiatric or mental health disabilities, as well as those who may be blind or deaf or who have physical disabilities. So a very broad definition.
And are there state standards, or I guess federal standards for that matter, that say, okay, in the case of certain disabilities, the state does have an obligation to step in, or in other situations, there are discrimination protections? What's the state of law on this?
So the Americans with Disabilities Act does protect parents with disabilities, theoretically, in these cases. And the ADA says that state agencies cannot discriminate against a person with a disability based simply on their disability. And it also puts the onus on states to provide certain accommodations. Unfortunately, a lot of states don't comply with this law and mandate. And moreover, every state has their own child welfare law, which says when they can terminate a parental right. And more than two-thirds of the states in the United States include disability as grounds for terminating parental rights.
And the goal, I guess, would be to protect children if a state stepped in and terminated parental rights. But you say it's more discrimination than concern for child welfare when this happens, in many cases, not in every case.
Yeah, no, of course, and not every case. But, you know, there's a long-standing research out there, decades of research now, that shows that parents with disabilities aren't inherently worse parents, that most poor outcomes aren't a result of the disability per se, but any negative outcomes would really just be a result of the situation in which they live. So if they live in poverty or have inadequate housing, that may lead to worse outcomes for children, but that would be the same for all parents, no matter if they have a disability or not. But nonetheless, there's this belief that because someone has a disability, they are just inherently unable to raise their children safely. And this is often just due to bias and speculation rather than any actual harm.
Robin Powell is with us. She's an attorney. She's a research associate at the National Center for Parents with Disabilities. She says parents with disabilities are often treated unfairly in the legal system and child protective system and beyond. And Robin, you've mentioned kind of the double standard. And I think you wrote if a kid of non-disabled parents shows up at school with a bruise, probably nobody thinks twice, just normal, kid clumsiness, whatever. If a child of a parent with disabilities shows up with the same bruise, people get more worried. They raise their eyes, sets off alarm bells.
Right. And one of the mothers I interviewed for the piece you're talking about actually talked about how at one point the school reported her because her daughter's ponytail was too tight, they said. And somehow that resulted in a referral to child welfare. And that is clearly just ridiculous. I don't think a non-disabled parent would be referred to child welfare system if they're daughter's ponytail was too tight. So I think that does highlight really the discrimination and bias that these parents face.
Are there legal pushbacks around the country by parents with disabilities?
Yeah, so there has been a lot of advocacy by parents with disabilities, particularly in the last decade, I would say. Parents with disabilities are going to court more often trying to fight their rights. And also, advocates across the state are working with their state legislators to change the legislation. So a number of states have now passed legislation that specifically says that a parent with a disability cannot be discriminated based on their disability.
I imagine we're going to invite listeners in a bit at 800-642-1234. People listening are probably thinking, okay, in many cases, yeah, but isn't there some point with a mental or physical disability where the demands of parenting are just too demanding?
I would say that you just have to look at the individual family, and anytime you make any sort of broad statement, that is going to result in discrimination. And the research really does show that parents with disabilities aren't inherently worse. The children don't have worse outcomes. And in fact, there are some really positive outcomes that come with having a parent with a disability.
What are some of those positive outcomes?
So children tend to be more open-minded if they have a parent with a disability, more compassionate, more resilient. They have stronger bonds with their family. All of this has been grounded in research and found that these families really are stronger.
And what would you want somebody who's maybe working with a local protective services organization or maybe a school to know maybe before they overreact in a situation?
Yeah, I forgot to mention that I actually was a social worker at one point, so I am very empathetic. I know that no one is out there inherently, you know, saying, I need to take away these kids. I think that people really are doing this because they believe it's in the interest of children. But I don't think that the rights of parents with disabilities and the rights of children are not mutually exclusive. So I would encourage those to really think about why they believe these children should be removed. Is there some sort of bias and speculation drawing this, or is there an actual harm?
And you mentioned, in addition to being treated without discrimination, the Americans with Disabilities Act, in some cases requiring accommodation for parents with disabilities. What kind of accommodations are required in theory? How do they work out in practice?
So what I mean by accommodations is if a child and a family ends up involved with the Child Protective Services, these agencies are required to provide accommodations. So it's things like even just providing documentation in Braille for a blind parent, explaining things to someone who has an intellectual disability, providing sort of training. So a lot of parents who end up with the Child Protective Services end up having to go to parent training. And unfortunately, this training is often not accessible for people who have disabilities. Things like providing interpreters for deaf people, things like that.
Robin Powell is with us. She's an attorney, writer, and research associate at the National Research Center for Parents with Disabilities. She says parents with disabilities face a lot of discrimination. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you raised by a parent with a disability? Are you a parent with a disability yourself? What have you encountered for better or worse? Call in now at 800-642-1234. Or if you have questions or thoughts for our guest on this topic, 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue the conversation with Robin Powell. She's an attorney, writer, and researcher focused on disability law and policy. She says that parents with disabilities are often treated unfairly in the court systems and face a higher risk of termination of their parental rights. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this your story as a parent or a child of a parent with disabilities? Talk a little bit about what life is like or was like for you in this situation, and if you felt like you were treated differently, if you got unfair scrutiny maybe from a local child welfare service of some sort. And if you have questions for our guest, you can join in too. 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll go to our callers now. Becky is with us in Oshkosh. Becky, hi.
Hi. My statement really is we raise these people with disabilities to high standards, yet we have normal parents who aren't raised to any standards. In the case, for instance, the one with the 13 children who were ill-treated in that house, and they weren't held to any standards.
Becky, thanks for the call. Robin, she's saying she's agreeing with you, a double standard here.
Yeah, there absolutely is a double standard, and we have this high expectation that a parent with a disability needs to be able to do it all.
Thanks a lot for that call, Becky. As a culture, how do we start to change that, Robin?
I think it really comes down to how we look at disability as a society. Disability has always been viewed as something bad, and that people with disabilities should not reproduce, they're incapable, and that's just not the case. So many people with disabilities live really fulfilling lives. I'm a woman with a disability, and I've had a great life, even though I have a disability. It's probably because I have a disability. So I think it all comes back to how do we look at disability, how do we understand disability?
What would need to change on a legal level? Is this just a matter of saying, okay, we've got the Americans with Disabilities Act, we need to observe it and things will get better, or are there legal changes needed?
Well, you know, in a dream world, we have the ADA. It's 27 years old. This should not be an issue. Unfortunately, it is. So I think it's going to be on states to really look at their own policies and change legislation. And then the courts, they really need to start looking at the ADA and how these cases do apply.
Now, for a parent with a disability who feels like, you know, I think I might be being unfairly treated, I might be being discriminated against, what kind of legal recourse would they have?
They should absolutely get an attorney if they are facing any sort of child protective case. And also just reaching out to other parents with disabilities, because I think understanding and getting experiences from people who have been through this is really helpful in navigating this system.
We're talking about parents with disabilities. Robin Powell is with us. She's an attorney. She's a researcher. She looks at disability law and policy. In a couple pieces lately, she's written that parents with disabilities are often treated unfairly in the legal system, by Child Protective Services and elsewhere. You can join in if you have a story yourself or a question for our guest. Call in now at 800-642-1234. Let's go to another caller now. Angela is with us in Austin, Texas. Angela, hi.
Hello.
Do you have a story for us, Angela?
I do. I'm currently going through a CPS battle. It's a, my disability, my main one would probably be that I'm agoraphobic, so I'm not about getting out the house unless I absolutely need to. I don't interact with people while I'm outside the house. I pretty much keep to myself. I'm on a fixed income, so, you know, prices have gone up in Austin. I felt my best interest was to get a roommate or a few. We went through quite a bit. But through the whole thing, you know, I'm making sure my child is okay. You know, he's fed, he's smart, he's very intelligent, he's four.
All right. We heard some of Angela's story. Her son is staying away with her sister while she tries to get things together. Robin, what would you say to a parent in that situation to deal with the legal system if need be?
I would say you need to make sure you have really good representation. Try to find an attorney who specializes in representing parents with disabilities, and then make sure that you get all of the supports that you may need in place. And again, I think it's really important to try to reach out to parents who have similar disabilities if you can, because I think sharing those stories really is useful.
Angela, thanks for the call, and good luck to you. We'll go next to Jane calling in northeastern Wisconsin. Jane, hi.
I represent parents with disabilities, and you are absolutely correct.
Jane's cutting in and out there.
Make a judgment about.
Nope, not getting enough of Jane. The gist of her story, our producer says she's an attorney who represents disabled parents, and she says school districts hold parents to a higher standard. She sees all the time. Do you see this as being common in schools, Robin?
Yeah, I think that schools are often the people who refer children to Child Protective Services the most, just because they see these kids every day.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Robin, what would you say to people in school districts? As you say, you're a former social worker yourself. You have empathy for the job people are doing in schools as well. What would you suggest to a school district in setting policy and standards?
I think that, you know, one of the big things is to try to work with families, and that includes working with parents with disabilities. And if you have any concerns, really reach out to the family. And also, I think you have to check yourself a little and see, you know, is this an actual concern, or is this something that I am speculating against because I know the parent has a disability? And obviously, if there is an actual issue, you definitely need to report it. But I think it's really important that we reflect a little on how we view disability.
Do you see things changing over time, getting better or worse?
I think that overall things are getting better. I mean, we're now 27 years past the ADA, and people are increasingly living out in the community. They're working, they're going to school, they're being members of their society, community. And so now people with disabilities are often becoming parents at rates that weren't this high before. We just want what so many non-disabled people want. And I think that that exposure is really starting to change the minds. And I think that as we hear stories like the Amy Fabrini and Eric Ziegler that I spoke about earlier in Oregon, these stories are starting to get into people's minds and understanding of the issues.
Are there places, as you research and look around the country, are there places, whether it's the legal system there or the schools there or whatever, that you think are getting it right?
You know, I don't know that there's one in particular, but there are a number of states who have recently passed legislation that is really good at protecting the rights of parents with disabilities, and I think that all states should really be considering this. And on our website, which is centerforparentswithdisabilities.org, we actually have a map where you can see all the states that have passed this legislation, and I think that's really something that all states should consider.
We've spent a lot of time on the legal side of things. You mentioned earlier the idea of getting support. Are there support networks online, in person, formal, informal, for parents with disabilities where they can share their stories, their experiences?
Yeah, absolutely. So social media has been a really great option for a lot of parents to connect with parents across the country. And I'm also the co-founder of the Disabled Parenting Project. And that is an online community that's for parents and prospective parents with disabilities. And I encourage other parents who are out there or people who are thinking about becoming parents to really check our website out, disabledparenting.com, as well as our social media, because it is thousands of parents with disabilities, and they're all sharing their experiences.
I wanted to ask how important that is, because I think any parent, it can feel kind of isolating, and you know a lot of other people are parenting, but your story is unique in some ways. How important is that social connection for any parents, but parents with disabilities in particular?
You know, I mean, I think any parent, they need a support network. And when you have a disability, you're in this unique circumstance where you don't have anyone to model. You know, you grew up probably with parents who do not have disabilities. And whether we like it or not, we raise our children the way we were raised. And if we don't have anyone to model because our parents weren't disabled, we don't really know, you know, the best techniques. And that's where getting this support from other parents who have similar circumstances is such an important thing.
Do you see people stepping forward maybe on these social networks and becoming those role models?
Absolutely. There's a number of parents out there who are absolutely these role models. And the two people that I co-founded the Disabled Parenting Project with are both mothers with disabilities, and they are really the role models, I think.
And I'm trying to think of people in pop culture. When I think of role models, I think, are there people in the TV or movies or books we consume? Are there people you look at out there in the pop culture world, fictional or real, that might serve as role models?
You know, unfortunately, at this point, there are not. Disability just not really represented very well in pop culture, unfortunately. There are movies out there. So I Am Sam was out in the early 2000s, and that involved a dad who had an intellectual disability who had lost custody of a child. So I do think that movie did a good job at exploring the issue. The only issue I would say is that it didn't involve an actual actor with a disability as the dad, so that would be my only complaint. So I'd love to see more out there in pop culture around this issue.
And you mentioned the support network. Is there a place out there where people in your networks are sharing their stories? So maybe people without disabilities can go in, see what life is like, and maybe alter their opinions?
Yeah, so Disabled Parenting Project's website, which is disabledparenting.com, it involves a blog where all different parents with disabilities write blogs on their experiences. They share photos and videos. And I think that just seeing those is really important, and it changes perspectives.
We'll leave it there for now. Robin, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
I've been talking to Robin Powell, attorney, writer, and researcher. Her work focuses on disability law and policy. Her piece for the online website Pacific Standard is called Parents with Disabilities Face an Uphill Battle to Keep Their Children. She's also a research associate at the National Center for Parents with Disabilities. It's still time for you to share your story over at the Ideas Network Facebook page and find a links to some information, including Robin's article. If this is your story, if you're a parent with disabilities, we'd love for you to share that story over there. You could also email us, ideas@wpr.org. Also, if you're the child of a parent with disabilities, talk a little bit about growing up. Maybe if you saw yourself being treated differently because of that. Again, share your stories. Find more info at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Here's a story I missed over the weekend. About 20 campers in the Waupaca area celebrated the annual Winter Butt Hang, camping out and sleeping in hammocks, apparently right in the middle of January. As reported in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, the campers eat a lot to keep the calories on. They appreciate the lack of mosquitoes. This event goes back 7 years. Over the years, the crew has hammocked, if that's a verb, it is now, hammocked in temperatures as low as -40. We all have our ways of dealing with winter. J. Carlisle Larson's in here.
Yeah, I think winter.
Would you do this?
Yeah, I actually think I was reading the article, and I think I probably would do it if given the opportunity and a whole lot of courage. I also don't like bugs, so that's already a selling point for me, but I do like being outside.
Yeah. So we've heard about ice fishing yesterday. People had their polar plunges recently. This whole idea of just like, I'm not going to avoid winter. I'm in a hammock in it. Does that appeal to you?
Yeah. I mean, we were talking earlier about how on New Year's Day, I ran that 5 mile race in Middleton. It was -8 with a -23 wind chill and still managed to do it. It was still super hard.
Would you do it again?
Oh, yeah. I would totally do it again.
The most I've done, my thing is on the coldest, worst, snowiest day of the year, I'll get, if I'm downtown or whatever, an ice cream cone and eat it walking outside. It's not a 5 mile run.
Really,
it's not a hammock overnight.
I don't know. Maybe it is.
No, we're embracing
the cold. It's your hammock. It's how you hammock.
Here on Central Time.